Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Associate Professor in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University. This is episode CXCVI, Fulvia. Fulvia came from a Roman noble family and is strongly associated with a string of influential husbands, most notably Mark Antony. She was influential and powerful in her own way, and would go on to play an important role in the Perusine War against Octavian. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
Fulvia was an elite Roman woman. She was alive during the late Republic, So we think she died about 40 BCE. And she came from a family called the Fulvi, not surprising. That was her father's name, Fulvius, so she becomes Fulvia. And they are an important Roman family, so her father isn't a new man. There's a whole line of consuls and senators back there. And she seems to be the only child of these two important parents, Marcus Fulvius Bambalio, great name, And Sempronia, who was extremely aristocratic. The Sempronii, they go way back, as much as, if not more, than the Fulvi, and through them she inherits a huge amount of money.
Right, so not only is Fulvius an important man, but he married above his station.
Yeah, well, certainly as good as, and this Sempronia, there's actually some debate about this, but a lot of people think she might be the Sempronia who appears in the Catiline conspiracy. Who is, certainly from the point of view of the sources we've got, one of the bad guys who joins with Catiline.
Okay. So,
and she shouldn't do that because she's from such a good, important family. So she may have had political involvement herself. But as I say, we're not entirely sure she is that Sempronia.
But considering Fulvia, that might be, you know, runs in the family.
Yeah, well, we'll see. We'll see.
Okay. All right. So we've got that background for her, but you also said there that she inherits a lot of money. And I guess this background, this money, is part of what makes Fulvia so important in Rome.
It does and it doesn't give her power.
Yeah.
In that she may not have had control of it, given the state of women's power in the late Republic. So a lot of people have talked as if this made her an attractive proposition for marriage. And as we'll see, she marries three very important men. But it may be that her father or a man in her family continued to control that money. However, she would have had a big dowry, which whoever marries her gets control of while they're married, at least. So we probably shouldn't overplay the money element. You know, this is not a Victorian British setup where all of the woman's money goes to the husband. Unless she has a very old-fashioned kind of marriage, which there's no sign of, her father stays in control.
Okay. But if she had a brother, it would have been a completely different story. He would have been a very powerful man. But having said that, we should talk about briefly what we have for sources when it comes to this. And we have a lot of Cicero talking about Fulvia, and you rolled your eyes. So tell me what the eye roll is. And I should say, we've got a lot of Cicero, unfortunately, talking about Fulvia. He's not a fan.
So Cicero talks about her because of the people she marries primarily, and he's not a fan of any of them. Just as a bit of a looking ahead, all three of them are tribunes of the plebs, and therefore become almost instant enemies of Cicero in a big way, one in particular, or two in particular. So he's coming from that point of view. Having said that, some scholars have made the point that there are occasions where he doesn't attack Fulvia, and he might have done. Sort of early on, especially before her final marriage, he doesn't take that opportunity, which suggests that he's not always using her as a kind of scapegoat or a way of criticizing the husbands too. So it's quite difficult. It's very difficult when you've got mostly hostile sources.
Yeah.
Cicero doesn't always seem as hostile as he might, is about the best we can say.
I think that that's maybe because, well, you know, we're going to get into this. I think that that is maybe because sometimes when Cicero says something as a criticism, we'll go, oh, she's kick ass. Look at what she's doing.
Yeah.
But Cicero means it as an insult.
Yeah.
And that's because we're coming at it from a different viewpoint.
And we do have to be careful with Cicero because of exactly that. that some scholars have taken that to mean she was really in there at the center of politics. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she's a role model for women.
Yeah.
And that's absolutely not how she would have been seen until very recently. And exactly, Cicero is, he's primarily using this kind of rhetoric, which there may be some truth beneath it, but he's exaggerating almost certainly. And he's doing it not particularly because he cares that much about Fulvia, but to say that husband can't even control her.
Mm.
She's out there doing this stuff. Why is whichever husband I hate at the time not keeping her in the household under control? And he doesn't even have to say it out loud because that's always implicit in describing her as being powerful.
So the first quote that we've got here, which is from Cicero's Philippics, which, well, see our episode previously on the Philippics, regarding her father, Bambalio, a man of no account at all. Nothing could be lower than he was, a fellow who got his surname as a sort of insult derived from the hesitation of his speech and the stolidity of his understanding.
Nasty Cicero. Cicero may know, but quite often that third name, that cognomen, isn't attached to that person particularly. It's come down their family. So
okay.
It may have been some ancestor who got this name. But that word Bambalane, it probably is related to Bambalane, which is Greek for to stutter.
Mm. It's just Cicero having a dig.
Yeah. I mean, his name means chickpea. So,
yeah,
so. You say. But yeah, but of course it means a lot to Cicero giving a speech, talking about someone being a stutterer.
Yeah.
You do the math.
Very important. Okay. So unfortunately, we are going to talk about Fulvia in the way of who was she married to.
Mm.
And that is unfortunately how we talk about many Roman women. So,
yeah.
So who was she married to?
And I have to say, I did a little experiment where I looked in the index of one of the translations I was using. I looked up Fulvia and she isn't mentioned by name in the passage that the index refers back to.
Okay. And
often it's his wife.
Mm.
It might have been Appian, actually, his wife and his mother and the children.
Okay.
She's part of that list. None of them named.
Oh.
That's what we're dealing with. All right. Her first marriage is to one of Cicero's big enemies, Clodius Pulcher, who was a very famous tribune of the plebs. You shouldn't say that he was part of Julius Caesar's party as such, partly because the word party is incorrect. You know, political parties didn't exist in antiquity.
Mm.
But at some point during the 50s, he takes the part of Julius Caesar, and when he's tribune of the plebs, he's somebody, remember the tribunes of the plebs have the veto, so he's someone who can wield that on behalf of Caesar, for Caesar's policies, for his veterans, and this is when Caesar's in Gaul, so it's really important for him to have power back home.
Yeah.
And Clodius is one of these people. His full name is Publius Clodius Pulcher. The Pulcher bit at the end is Latin for beautiful, pretty.
Yes.
And don't think Cicero didn't make use of that. Fulvia probably married him around 62 BCE. They had two children, a son who was named after Clodius and a daughter called Claudia. There's a whole thing about whether you use Clodius with an O or Claudius with an AU. Mm. Clodius with an O seems like he was doing that deliberately to make himself a bit more like the common man.
Yes.
Which the Claudii certainly weren't. For one thing, he had to have his status kind of moved downwards to get to be tribune of the plebs.
Clodius doesn't last for very long. He's infamously murdered outside of Rome by Milo and a mob.
Mm.
And Cicero wrote quite a lot about this because he was involved in the trial.
Yeah.
And that's where we've got the main account of that.
Pro Milone, for Milo. So he's defending the murderer of Clodius. And this is part of the kind of gang warfare that's going on in Rome at the time, which is going to lead to the civil wars shortly afterwards. So Clodius was murdered in 52. Civil war starts in 49.
Mm.
We're on that track. And Cicero is starting to, in as much as he does, take sides with the senatorial side. Milo's seen as kind of acting for Pompey.
Yes. Fulvia is mentioned in amongst all of that.
Yeah. So she gives testimony at the trial of Milo, along with her mother as well. And as Cicero says, created much emotion amongst the onlookers with their tears. That's the mother and Fulvia's tears.
Mm.
So I guess this is a point at which she can speak out in public. And again, that's important, but it's not perhaps so unusual. And our sources then go on to say that Fulvia seems to use the influence that Clodius had. So Clodius had controlled gangs in Rome. Don't think that he was the goodie as opposed to Milo the baddie just because he gets murdered by him. They were both gang warlords, basically.
Mm.
But Fulvia, apparently, according to our sources, largely Cicero, uses this influence after his death. So she becomes a kind of gang leaderess,
yeah,
according to Cicero.
Curious as to how extensive her power was over these gangs. She seems to have had some influence to get them to do a few things, but I don't know how extensive it would have been.
Yeah, well, certainly she makes use of Clodius's body and puts it on display. And again, this is according to Cicero, amongst the onlookers with their tears. This is also in Appian and Dio, I think, but they're probably leaning on Cicero.
Mm.
So she's using the corpse in the way that Caesar's corpse would later be used after his murder in 44. You have to wonder whether this becomes a kind of literary topos. So this is a bit more public than you might expect of a wife, if true. But the fact that she is effectively seeking vengeance is something that is beholden to the family to do. You might expect it to be a male family member, but remember, she's only been married for 10 years at this point, so her son is not old enough to do it.
Okay, yeah.
And she may be the only person left to do it.
Mm.
So again, she may be speaking out more than a woman typically did, but have to always have that caveat that this is coming from Cicero originally.
So very soon after that, if the dates line up, it's about 9 months, which would have been the length of a mourning period.
It is, to make sure that any subsequent children are definitely...
Of course. Okay, yeah. A posthumous. Yeah. Sure. So she gets married to Gaius Scribonius Curio. Whose call would that have marriage have been? That would have fallen back to her father, I guess.
Yes.
So this is another kind of alliance marriage.
Yeah, for sure. Like all of Fulvia's husbands, he's very much aligned with the populist cause, if you want to call it that, with the populares. He will become a tribune of the plebs as well.
Yeah.
In fact, very soon after their marriage, he's just come back from military service governorship in Asia, and then he's kind of up for more magistracies, so he becomes tribune of the plebs. And he comes from a family, and he himself had supported Clodius in some of his strife. So way back, around the time he got married to Fulvia, Clodius had been involved in a scandal called the Bonadea scandal, where he'd gone into a women-only ritual. It's the reason Caesar had to divorce his wife.
Yeah. And sounds familiar.
Yeah. Curio and his family had defended Clodius for his weird playboy behavior. I don't even know what to call it.
No, that's strange. That probably covers it.
And he was also close to Mark Antony, who we'll see is going to turn up soon. So people talk about the Clodian legacy being taken on by Curio and by Fulvia. That joins Curio and Clodius together, I suppose. And if you believe that Fulvia had control of these gangs, gives that control to Curio. But this marriage doesn't last very long at all, because Curio dies in war the year after his tribunate, fighting for Julius Caesar against Juba.
Okay. All right. And Fulvia is pregnant with their son at that point.
Yeah.
So wait 9 months.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I have to say, at the same time, some of that is breaking down, because to jump ahead a bit in history, it's not what Octavian does, is it?
Mm. At this point, she's got 3 children, but... And I say but like that should be a reason not to marry her. She's still an attractive marriage prospect enough for Mark Antony to be interested.
I don't think that parenthood works in the same way for an elite Roman as we might think of it. This is not a responsibility to take on.
Exactly.
It's a responsibility, but it's not a burden. If you're an elite Roman with plenty of funds, then this is a connection with other Romans, in fact, to have these stepchildren.
Yeah.
It might be seen as a good rather than a deterrent. She's still very wealthy, so whatever her dowry will be considerable. Even if you minimize, and there's a scholar called Diana Delia who does minimize what the sources tell us about Fulvia's political power, nevertheless, she is a link back to those 2 tribunes, and therefore she might well have helped whatever power Clodius and Curio had in the city of Rome, that to be transferred to her next husband, who is a man we've never heard of before, isn't he? No, it's Mark Antony. She marries Mark Antony.
So is this his first marriage?
It's the first marriage we know of Mark Antony, yes. Mm. They get married around 47, 46 BCE. So there probably is a gap between Curio dying and the marriage to Antony.
Mm.
And if you do buy into Fulvia having political clout, then Antony by this period is very much associated with, attached to Julius Caesar, who's really powerful. You know, this is the era of the civil war between 49 and 45 between Caesar and the Pompeians, and Antony is front and center there. So this is a marriage that solidifies that political power, I think. It's a good marriage for both of them, I'd argue.
Mm.
Cicero gives us some salacious gossip that they'd actually been fooling around together a lot longer, indeed when she was married to her former husbands, which I have very little time for. Frankly, it's the kind of thing Cicero would say. He uses this marriage in his criticism of Antony in the Philippics in particular, where he says, and again, we might think this is kind of cute, that Antony disguises himself so that he can run back to Fulvia at some point during the civil wars.
Yeah.
And throws off the disguise so that he can embrace her and be with her.
That's criticism.
Absolutely, because it means he's being kind of dominated by his passion for Fulvia. You shouldn't feel passion for your wife.
He's putting his passion ahead of his obligations to the state.
Yeah.
Oh, how dare he? Yes.
Yeah, no, that too. Yeah. But even if he did it, if he had nothing in particular going on, I think Cicero would regard it as a bit much.
Mm.
Excessive. Just being controlled by your emotions.
Okay.
That's the way he attacks Antony. Whether any of it was true is questionable.
So on paper, Mark Antony has a lot in common with Fulvia's previous husbands. So I imagine that she could have worked behind the scenes much in the same way for him as she did for them and advocated in their interests.
Absolutely. And that's what Catherine Welsh argues. And I think she's probably right. I don't fully agree with Diana Delia that there's no evidence that it's all kind of wishful thinking is what Delia thinks. Given what is about to happen, Fulvia's involvement in a war,
yeah,
I think that she must have had some political clout or she wouldn't have been there. There'd be no point in her being involved in military and political action at all, even if the sources are exaggerating quite how much involvement she did have in that war. I think that it's a bit of a coincidence. She's married to three tribunes of the plebs, and then she's one of the few women who turns up in a battle, three Roman women. The circumstantial evidence looks like she is maneuvering, even if it's behind the scenes.
Not just maneuvering as well, but that these are her political beliefs as well, that these are principles that she also holds.
Yeah, I mean, of course, she doesn't fully get to make the decisions about who she marries, but she's brought up in a family that clearly holds with those beliefs. So it wouldn't be surprising if she is much more on the populares side.
Yeah.
It's where her allegiances must lie, even if it's about power, the power for her family. Even if it's not, I think Caesar's veterans should get land here and let's cancel debts. Even if she's not down with that nitty gritty, she is part of that power structure that's on Caesar's side.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. So Fulvia and Mark Antony have two sons. We've got Marcus Antonius Antyllus and Iulius.
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 Antonius.
And Iulius Antonius.
Yeah, haven't heard anyone really talk about this, but they are interesting names. I mean, Antyllus is a Greek name originally, and Iulius harks back to the name of Aeneas's son in mythology, the one who, Ascanius, who takes the name Iulius, and that's how the Julian family claimed descent.
Nice.
So the mythological connection. And Antony claimed connection to that family as well through his mother's line. So that may be what he's doing there.
So fast forward slightly to the death of Caesar, jumping over quite a lot of events that have happened in Rome at that point. But what happens to Mark Antony's power and by extension to Fulvia's position within Roman society then?
Well, Mark Antony has become incredibly powerful even when Caesar was still alive. But when he dies, I mean, we're going to see a tussle between Antony and Octavian, but on the face of it, although Octavian is the heir, he's very young, and Antony, he has control of the city potentially, and Caesar's laws are maintained, and this is good for Antony. So it looks like in 44, 43, Antony is in a position of power and Fulvia is there standing beside him with whatever power she brings to this position.
But it's a very brief kind of position that they have there, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. It is, because it starts to fall apart, particularly between Octavian and Antony, and the Senate, and we get this largely from Cicero, is trying to maneuver Octavian to oppose Antony.
Mm.
So the big feud that's starting to happen now, it will end up Octavian and Antony, but it's really Cicero and Antony.
Mm.
And he's facing down Antony, trying to take him apart and trying to use Octavian as a puppet for their political needs, their political desires.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And they send him off to battle. And at that point, he becomes more powerful. But during that sweet spot of, I guess, when Cicero was writing and performing the Philippics, how is he portraying Fulvia's actions in Rome?
Well, as we get in a kind of stereotype of women in later texts as manipulative, as somebody who's much too involved in political affairs.
Mm-hmm.
And I've kind of already said this, but this is when it comes to its high point, that reflects bad on Antony because he can't control the women in his household. They shouldn't be seen out in public, and yet they are being. When I say that, you know, Fulvia, because she's wealthy, even though technically a man controls her wealth, she would have been involved in business affairs. And Cicero doesn't really have a problem with that. I think it's the crossover into politics that he can use against his enemies, however true it is or not.
So Antony is declared an enemy of the state, partly on the back of Cicero's campaigning for it.
Totally, at least on the back of it.
As he would like us to believe. What is Fulvia's reaction and what are the avenues available to her to try and retain the position that she's got?
She's there supporting Antony. So this happens early in 43.
Yeah.
And this means that if you're declared an enemy of the state, then that means no one should be helping you. No one should be giving you food or water. Mm. You know, you've got to flee, basically.
But Antony is safely outside of Rome. Fulvia is there living with it.
Yeah. So according to Appian, and I should preface anything about Appian and even Dio by saying they, I think, have imbibed the Augustan propaganda around Fulvia, and it'll become clear why there is some when we talk about the aftermath of this. But Octavian, Augustus, not a fan. I mean, she's married to his eventual enemy.
Like shock horror.
Yeah. So you should bear that in mind when thinking about even what Appian has to say. And of course, he's read Cicero as well.
Mm.
So, but with all of that at the beginning, disclaimer, this is what Appian has to say in book 3 of the Civil Wars. The mother, the wife, and the son of Antony, who was still a young man, that's his son, and his other relatives and friends went around the whole night visiting the houses of influential men and beseeching them.
Mm.
So they're really advocating for him.
Yeah.
And she's one of a larger group here, but still. In the morning, they put themselves in the way of those going to the Senate house. So they're literally lying their bodies in front of the senators to stop them going in. They fell at their feet with wailing and lamentation and in mourning garments, crying out alongside the doors. Some of the senators were moved by these cries, this spectacle, this so sudden change of fortune. So they are effective in their kind of theater. They're wearing mourning clothes as if Antony's dead.
Yeah.
And they do garner some sympathy.
It's interesting that you call it the word theater, though, because this also reminds me of her behavior, the presentation that she makes of Pulcher's body.
Yes, exactly. Clodius Pulcher.
Clodius Pulcher. So she's lamenting, she's mourning, she's displaying public grief. If it ain't broken, don't fix it, I guess. It worked once, it can work again.
Yeah, but you know, this does make me think that we should put this into the context, and I don't think we should imbue this with our kind of modern reading of emotions, but nevertheless, she has already lost two husbands in violent circumstances.
Mm.
One of them murdered, one of them lost in warfare. And she probably thinks she's going to lose the third because he's been declared an enemy of the state. So this is a huge crisis for her and her family. And even though it's not made clear in Appian, I think that he is trying to direct his reader towards that word theatre that she's putting it on.
But how else would you react, I guess?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
That, you know, the going into mourning is something that Roman men would have done as well if they're accused of a crime,
mm-hmm.
right? They'll appear in, if they're senators, in the Senate, in with their hair all straggly and they won't shave their beard and they'll be wearing a dark toga, the toga puller. I will use the word theatre, but it's very common in Roman society. I guess it's less common to see women doing it in public. But this is a real crisis. And the fact that they're prepared to lay their bodies in front of men to prove how devastated they are.
Mm.
If it happened, it's extraordinarily brave. So I think we should bear in mind that it looks like Fulvia is prepared to put herself out there, literally.
Yeah.
Put her body on the line.
Okay.
Also, we generally get a lot of negative evidence about Fulvia, as we've already mentioned. So with Cicero, it's almost entirely negative. But we do get in Appian a speech defending Antony at 358 following, just after he's given us a kind of summary of one of Cicero's Philippics. He gives us a speech in defense of Antony. I mean, it's almost certainly not what was said, but his version of it, by Piso. And Piso mentions Fulvia, or again, the wife of, I don't think he mentions her name, in his speech defending Antony. And he uses her as proof that Antony hasn't abandoned the city and betrayed it. Cicero has said, look, he's gone off there to get an army. He's going to come back and attack Rome. He's a traitor.
Mm-hmm.
And Piso says, well, look, he's left Fulvia and his mother and his children in Rome, basically as hostages.
Yeah.
So why would you think that? So her presence there could be used to defend Antony, to
okay.
make him look innocent.
Yes.
She's important enough that he wouldn't want to lose this wife. Therefore, you can't read his actions as treacherous. I think it actually possibly downplays her public activity. She just is. She is his wife and she's still here. He'd have taken her with him if he was planning to come back and take over Rome.
Depends how important Rome. She is to him. That's another thing which I guess will come up later on as well.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the relationship between Fulvia and Antony is something that Cicero and Antony's enemies continue to play on.
Mm. But having said that, we get to the point where Antony and Octavian and Lepidus briefly lay down their arms.
You say his name quietly because he's so unimportant.
Just as a little afterthought.
Yeah.
And Lepidus was also there. Briefly lay down their arms, come up with a treaty, and then you've got the second triumvirate, what we call the second triumvirate. They wouldn't have called it that.
They called it a triumvirate.
They did. They did. They wouldn't have called it the second triumvirate. Also, and this is a very important provision of the triumvirate, there is a marriage of Octavian to Fulvia's daughter.
Yeah, so her daughter by Clodius, Claudia, yeah. becomes Octavian's wife. So this is the triumvirate being solidified by marriage.
Mm.
Later on, after Fulvia's death, Mark Antony will marry Octavian's sister. Marriage is the normal way of getting these alliances going. And that's much more famous, I think, Mark Antony marrying Octavia later.
Mm.
But we've already got that happening right at the beginning with Octavian marrying Clodia. It gets very overshadowed, I think, because Octavian's last wife, Livia, just overshadows everything. And in a way, you could see Fulvia as a precursor of the kind of power that Livia could have, that we don't really remember that Fulvia was almost certainly instrumental in engineering this marriage.
Then we've got a period where they embark upon what we call the proscriptions, which is very bloody, taking out everything on your enemies kind of thing that those three rulers engage in. There's a lot of name swapping, there's lists drawn up, there's properties confiscated, there's people executed. And Fulvia is credited with suggesting a lot of these names and being quite active during this point, isn't she?
Yeah, and I think this is when the Augustan propaganda really comes into play, quite frankly, because all of these accounts are written from, we're going to stop getting Cicero quite soon.
Oh, yeah.
Because Cicero's murdered in 43.
Yeah.
Therefore, the accounts we've got from Appian and Dio are dependent upon a kind of, I would say, an Augustan whitewashing of this period. It seems like Augustus doesn't even want to blame Antony for some of the violence. So he certainly wants to distance himself from it. Other people were carrying out this kind of widespread free-for-all of killing Roman citizens and stealing their property. But he can kind of get one leap further by not blaming the triumviri. So even though he'll end up at war with Mark Antony, it seems like he wants to preserve the integrity of the triumvirate as a good thing. So the suggestions for a lot of these deaths are coming from Fulvia, is what we get in Appian and Dio. And,
wow.
And she has a very bloodthirsty reaction to the deaths. So she's motivated by hostilities, feuds, you know, wanting certain people's land who refuse to sell to her.
Just really petty at that point.
Yeah, according to Appian.
And I imagine after living through the events that she has, being up to her third husband, the violent death of her first husband especially, that she would have quite a long list of people that she would like to see prescribed, just quietly.
You're right. She would have had political enemies. I mean, they might well have tied in with Antony's political enemies,
yeah, I know,
of course.
I know, but she could have been very happy with some of this list.
But that's not how it's presented. It's not presented as political motivations. I'm by no means trying to whitewash Fulvia or Antony either. I mean, the prescriptions were hideous and bloody, and both of them would have had enemies, as you say. Mm. So they had reason to put people on these lists, and she might have been responsible for adding some of those names. But she's never credited with having those political motivations or even vengeance for what happened to her husband. Mm. It's always about greed. It's kind of the lowest possible motive.
So we're going to come to this very soon, but one of the names that Antony is definitely credited with putting on the list is Cicero. Mm. And I can imagine Fulvia would have gone, yes, top of the list, Cicero.
Well, major enemy of her first husband and her third husband.
Yeah, so but you know, for example, but there are others. What does it tell us specifically about Fulvia during the prescriptions?
So this is from Dio. We're in book 47 of Dio now, chapter 8, where Dio says, Antony killed savagely and mercilessly, not only those whose names had been posted, but likewise those who had attempted to assist any of them. So don't you help any of the proscribed, because he'll put your name on there.
Mm.
He always viewed their heads, even if he happened to be eating, and sated himself to the fullest extent on this most unholy and pitiable sight. So he really enjoyed the bloody part. And even Fulvia also caused the death of many, both to satisfy her enmity and to gain their wealth. In some cases, men with whom her husband was not even acquainted. So it's very personal, and it's just a woman being petty, as you say.
Mm.
At any rate, when he saw the head of one man, he exclaimed, I know not this man. He's kind of surprised that this head has turned up, and the implication is it was Fulvia who put the name there.
Mm.
When, however, the head of Cicero also was brought to them one day, he had been overtaken and slain in flight, Antony uttered many bitter reproaches against it and then ordered it to be exposed on the rostra more prominently than the rest. That's the speaker's platform, Yabu Suck Cicero. In order that it might...
Sorry, what was that? Back up a bit. Hold the phone. What was what?
Well, it's just, you know, rejoicing in the death of Cicero.
Okay, Yabu...
Sucks. Sucks to be you. All right, so
sorry,
I feel like
that.
We're detracting from the seriousness of Cicero being murdered here.
Yeah.
So Antony uttered many bitter reproaches against it and ordered it to be exposed on the rostra more prominently than the rest in order that it might be seen in the very place where Cicero had so often been heard declaiming against him.
Yeah,
so
right.
It's a really satisfying...
Kind of sticking it to him. Yeah, this is what you get. Yeah,
revenge. He puts the head there, back to the quote, together with his right hand, just as it had been cut off, so the hand that he wrote with. And Fulvia took the head into her hands before it was removed, and after abusing it spitefully and spitting upon it, set it on her knees, opened the mouth, and pulled out the tongue, which she pierced with the pins that she used for her hair, at the same time uttering many brutal jests.
Wow. That's the most vivid description we get of actions of Fulvia, I think.
Yeah, I'm not sure I believe a word of it.
I don't want to, but I can. I think that's the whole point of it.
Yeah, I mean...
He's done many slights. He's written many bad things about her. He's dragged her through the mud. Her reputation's very damaged, and she would have taken it very personally.
Possibly so, yeah. So look, it's not impossible that it happened. I think something important about this account to mention is that it is, and I guess it does, make us feel horrified about the behaviour of Antony and Fulvia. It's the kind of behaviour we'll see in some of the more excessive emperors as well.
Mm.
And of course, this account is written way into the imperial period. This is Dio, written in the 3rd century. But also, it bigs up the power of Cicero, that he has made these people so angry.
And
it's his head, his tongue, his hand that has done that. So it's the power of the pen, the power of the word, that they now have to take out this retribution upon his corpse. I do think it's a really dramatic story. And by the way, if we think of it as feeding out of Augustan propaganda, it does make me think of a text written during the Augustan period, which is Livy's History of Rome, where early on in the history, it's really mythical history, he has some members of the royal family do some dreadful things to each other. And the one that really springs to mind, because it involves a woman, is the murder of the second last king of Rome, Servius Tullius, who is murdered by his daughter and her lover so they can take over. And she tramples over his corpse in a chariot.
Wow.
So, which, you know, your own father.
Badass.
Given that patricide is the worst crime in Rome.
Yeah.
So women behaving in this out of control way against corpses seems to be a fear of the Romans in this period, something that they'll highlight as the worst possible behavior of a woman. Now, this isn't her father. Cicero isn't her father, although he is the father of the country. He has had that title. But it's a way of showing us a woman behaving in a most unwomanly way.
Mm.
It's bad behavior on Antony's part, but it's much worse for a woman.
So if we can jump forward in time again, there is a war with Antony and Octavian, who are still best buds at this point, against Brutus and Cassius. This is the Battle of Philippi. See previous episode with Steelbrand. And Brutus and Cassius are on the losing side of that. And Fulvia essentially finds herself very much on the we are in power in Rome side.
Yeah. I mean, this is what the triumvirate is for, partly to get rid of Brutus and Cassius. And apparently, you know, the Roman world now belongs to Antony and Octavian and Lepidus, but Antony has got by far the most experience and political clout. So she would have expected to be the wife of the man who's in power.
Pretty much, yeah.
And I think that's reasonable. Dio gives us a nasty little quote about this, though, saying that she was also standing in power.
See, I don't see it as nasty.
Yeah, well, it's intended to be nasty, believe me.
Yeah.
Let me read it out. It's from Dio, Book 48, Chapter 4. The following year, Publius Servilius and Lucius Antonius nominally became consuls. So this is Antony's brother.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
But in reality, it was Antonius and Fulvia. I think this is part of a tradition of, you know, the one we've mentioned
Julius
several
times. Julius and
Caesar? Yeah. Julius and Caesar. I mean, that's one man rather than Caesar and Bibulus. But here, yeah, not the person you expect. And even more of a kicker, it's a woman. She, the mother-in-law of Caesar, had no respect for Lepidus, which you don't either by the sounds of it.
Oh, just so. Anyway, keep going.
Because of his slothfulness, and managed affairs herself, so that neither the Senate nor the people transacted any business contrary to her pleasure. Mm. Wow, she's in control of Rome, according to Dio.
Very much so, yeah.
Hmm. Now, of course, on paper, she does have a lot of power, because two of the triumvirate she is related to by marriage. And if she can kind of block Lepidus out of having power, then she's really at the center of things. And look, maybe she was, but the tone of Dio is that this is something that should make us scared.
I see.
So is he using that because that's what's come down to us from Augustan propaganda? Is this what really happened? And his tone shows us what a state Rome was in at this point. But from our point of view, this is a woman who can exert some power. So as you imply, something to be celebrated. It's really hard to tell. And it's very frustrating that we can't know more and we don't have Fulvia's account and we don't have some less biased accounts.
Mm.
On the face of it, I would say the circumstantial evidence is that she was in a very good position to exert power. Not that she was sitting there as a co-consul.
Yeah, but every source that we've got from Cicero to Appian to Dio is treating the power that Fulvia has as a cautionary tale.
Mm, exactly.
That was Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Associate Professor in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you may cast your pod. Please leave a review. They are always very appreciated. You can like us on the Emperors of Rome Facebook page, and you can follow both of us on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans, I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. That's it today for Emperors of Rome. In the next episode, we will follow Fulvia into battle in the Perusine War. But until then, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.